good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, September 16th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Moscow Council to help pay for study of possible freight route to alleviate truck traffic in downtown Moscow and Pullman. Whitman County will pay 70%. UI History Department Chair Rebecca Schofield speaks on the history of females riding side saddle and dragon riding fiction. And no new measles in Spokane County. They may have avoided an outbreak. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Spokane region may have avoided a measles outbreak after two children in northern Idaho and a child in Spokane had measles in August. Two of those children were patients at Spokane's Sacred Heart Hospital, and health professionals were on edge that the measles cases may have spread to other people who were at the hospital. According to the Spokesman Review, Spokane Regional Health District epidemiologist Mark Springer said in an email yesterday, "We are outside the incubation period for the initial exposure that occurred at Sacred Heart. We have not heard of any subsequent cases in North Idaho, and the wastewater surveillance program in Coeur d'Alene has not detected measles since the earlier positive signals. It is possible that there may be cases where medical attention was not sought, but that is unlikely. We are optimistic that the response efforts with Providence and the high level of cooperation that we have seen with exposed persons that we may have avoided a larger transmission event or outbreak." An Idaho Panhandle Health District spokesperson told the Spokesman Review there have been no more confirmed cases of measles in their five-county region since the previous cases. It was unknown how the two Idaho patients got the disease, which raised the possibility of an undiagnosed person, possibly without symptoms, unknowingly spreading the disease. Measles presents with a high fever, usually runny nose and cough. It's distinguished by a rash that appears 3 to 5 days after initial symptoms, starting on the face and then moving down the body. The disease is so infectious because someone can spread it up to 4 days before the rash appears, which is typically happening 7 to 14 days after exposure. University of Idaho History Department Chair Rebecca Schofield gave a presentation at the UI Malcolm Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium today at the UI Library about dragon riding literature and its relationships to first through third wave feminism. Schofield said over the 20th century, American women rejected earlier edicts that they only ride side saddle on horses, which created a cultural obsession with stories about women befriending, controlling, and deploying a variety of beasts with the simple pressure of their thighs, a click of their tongue, or a flick of their wrist. She said some of the early roots of this obsession are actually related to the invention and popularization of the bicycle.
Let's just remind ourselves that in sort of Euro-American culture in the 19th century, women really didn't ride astride. Riding astride was seen to be damaging to your reproductive system and was something only really, essentially poor women would allow themselves to do. And so this comes out in the print culture of the time, right? So here we have the women at Seneca Falls talking about women's rights, and we have this political cartoon that says the leaders of the Women's Rights Convention taking an airing. And so we have, women sort of crassly showing their ankles and their knees, galloping, they're windswept, pretty much just misbehaving. So very early on, we're already seeing sort of political feminism get connected to the idea of riding astride. Now, we are in the West, and so a lot of people, right, like if you, like me, have spent a lot of time researching cowgirls, some of the books will be called, like, Riding Astride, Women of the West. But it's important to remember that as Euro-American settlers came west, they also brought ideas about Victorian femininity with them. So, for instance, this is Kitty Wilkins, who was the famed horse queen of Idaho. She was one of the only women to ever work as a horse seller. Like, she would travel around the nation and sell her horses at auction. She sold massive numbers of horses to both the U.S. Cavalry and to Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. And she really prided herself on riding side saddle. You can still see some of her memorabilia artifacts in the museum in Mountain Home. And one of the only things we still have from her is her side saddle. So it was really important to women in the sort of Victorian, late Victorian era in the United States to prove their femininity by doing really, really hard things like living in southern Idaho and, you know, walking around in a bustle and a corset while also maintaining their femininity by riding side saddle. So what changed? I argue in my book that the bicycle really helped change things. So the bicycle had been around for a while, but it kind of sucked and no one liked it. And you would really get hurt. And it was almost impossible to wear a dress and ride it. So around the 1890s, we get what's called the safety bicycle. So this allows, it has like much softer wheels. They're able to figure out how to drop the center bar so someone with a skirt can actually bicycle. They would also design cages. You can see the this here is called a dress cage, so that your dress wouldn't get caught in the wheel. And as women start bicycling, this really throws a wrench into the whole women can't ride horses astride. And so we have, for instance, a case in Central Park in New York where a very famous actress is riding astride her horse. She gets arrested for disturbing the peace. And it goes all the way up to Theodore Roosevelt, who was at the time the head of the police commissioners in New York. And he comes down and says, well, it's not technically illegal for women to ride astride. And we let them do it with bicycles. So we kind of have to let them start doing it with horses as well. And so women start using riding astride, horses and bicycles, as an explicit form of sort of a call for political power.
That was University of Idaho History Department Chair Rebecca Schofield speaking today at the UI Library during a Renfrew interdisciplinary colloquium. Schofield said the famous Dragon Riders of Pern fantasy series includes characters related to second wave feminism, and later Dragon Rider fantasy fiction included third wave feminist characters and heroines.
The storyline for Lessa and this notion that women are really ushering in a renaissance in Pern over this series. It's always female characters that are pushing society forward in these books. And this is very fascinating because at the same time, the ERA is being debated specifically around women being in the draft. So, for instance, Phyllis Schlafly, who read Stop ERA, came to Idaho and debated Hope Kading, who was a very famous Republican state legislator in, state legislator in Idaho. And Hope's response to the question, well, do you want to see your daughter drafted, was, what makes you think I'd rather have my son shot than my daughter? So there's really questions about how much can we protect women if we want them to be equal within a society. And you see this cropping up over and over again. And then the other really interesting aspect of Pern that I'll touch on is that it really leans in hard to this notion of shared power, that a golden queen and the werewoman who rides her cannot lead a were on her own. She has to be in a mated pair, right? She has to have a were leader. She is really in charge of a lot of the social and, I would say, nurturing aspects of were life, right? While he is the military leader. And this really played into, this really played into a lot of ideas about how feminists in the 1960s and 70s very much wanted to look back to what we now know as probably mythological matriarchal societies, right? So really from Seneca Falls forward, white women had invoked groups like the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois Confederacy to show that in other societies, women had held power in maternal councils, things like that. And that's really what crops up here. We see the sort of solidification of the idea of like the lance and the chalice and the sacred hoop. And a lot of white feminists start to use notions of past or non-white cultures to say, well, really what we need is shared authority. But again, that's still grounded in reproduction and an essentialized notion of heteronormative society.
That was University of Idaho History Department Chair Rebecca Schofield speaking at a University of Idaho Malcolm Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium today. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP programming is sponsored by listeners like you and by Essential Art Gallery and Fine Gifts at 203 South Main Street in Moscow. Showcasing high-quality art, pottery, jewelry, art glass, sculptures, scarves, textiles, wood and metal art, and fine chocolate and gifts from regional, national, and international artists. KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
Washington lawmakers have expanded the state's paid sick and safe leave time to allow for workers to use earned paid leave to attend immigration-related proceedings. The new law, which came into effect this summer, allows people to attend immigration hearings or meet with legal counsel for themselves or their family members without risking their income or employment. Hannah Sabio-Howell is with Working Washington and the Fair Work Center, groups that organize low-wage workers such as farm workers and restaurant staff, many of which are part of immigrant communities.
Expanding our paid sick and safe time law is an important way of keeping our communities stable at a time when particularly undocumented workers and families are needing to defend their livelihoods and their well-being.
Sabio-Howell notes this policy does not expand the amount of paid sick and safe hours that are available to workers, but rather the ways in which people can use them. The new law also expands the definition of family, Sabio-Howell explains, to include anyone depending on the worker for care, whether or not they are related or live together. As a result, workers can now use sick and safe leave to assist people outside their immediate family with immigration proceedings. She says this change will benefit the state's economy.
Workplaces stay whole, families stay whole when more workers and more of the members of their communities can rely on the care they need.
Joe Mizrahi is with UFCW Local 3000, a union representing 50,000 members working in grocery, retail, healthcare, and other industries that backed the new law. He says the next step is to make sure employers are following it.
We would always love to see stronger funding for enforcement on a statewide level, or to see laws like this pass in cities, which can seem duplicative, but actually then allows for city enforcement as well.
Mizrahi adds it may seem like a small change, but the new law will have a meaningful impact on immigrant communities. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Moscow City Council voted last night to approve a memorandum of understanding with Whitman County for the city to contract with Welch Comer for $45,000 to help complete the design and engineering study for an alternate east-west route for freight traffic in the area. Whitman County is applying for a Federal Transportation Department grant for the design work. Under the plan the City Council approved, Moscow would contribute $45,000 to planning and design, and transportation agencies on the other side of the state line would contribute the rest, partially funded by federal grants. Transportation officials in Washington have been looking at ways to alleviate freight traffic going through downtown Pullman. Moscow City Supervisor Bill Belknap told council members the freight route would also reduce truck traffic going through downtown Moscow.
we became aware that Whitman County was pursuing or planning to apply for a build grant, which is a federal transportation grant, to help fund improvements to Sand and Kirkendall roads as a alternative for freight traffic. Whitman County felt the improvements to Kirkendall Sand Road could be a good alternative. And I'll talk a little bit about traffic flows and why that is. But initially, when we became aware of that, it caused us some concern. Then in early 2025, so early this year, the Palouse Regional Transportation Planning Organization initiated a freight alternative study that was just concluded in June of this year. And that really took a look at all the potential alternatives that were available to help reduce truck traffic in downtown Pullman and kind of went through a list of those options. The goal of that study, again, was to explore those alternate freight routes that could reduce truck traffic in downtown Pullman. And it was completed by Welch Comer and Kittleson Associates, who were the consultants that worked on that study. Really, in the core downtown between Grand and Main, they were estimating between 1,400 and 1,500 trucks per day were traveling through Pullman. They estimated about 700, so about half of those either had a destination or were originating within Pullman. So you aren't going to divert those trips because they're either coming or going from Pullman. But there was a very strong east-west flow.
That was Moscow City Supervisor Bill Belknap speaking at last night's Moscow City Council meeting. Whitman County officials have been actively working to advance improvements to Sand Road and Kirkendall Road to provide an alternate east-west route for freight traffic.
The project, as they outlined it in the freight study, would include the installation of a traffic signal at Highway 8 and Mountain View intersection. There would be roadway improvements south on Mountain View to the intersection of Palouse River Drive, where there would be an intersection improvement. I think roundabout is what they were suggesting in that location. You'd have continued roadway improvements then to the west, and then really to city limits, and then out to the Washington state line. For us, Palouse River Drive is one of those historical county roads that doesn't really have a good structural base to the roadway. It's kind of one of those that's been a county road, graveled, chip sealed over time, built up over time, but it is a roadway that really does not have a good substantial roadway support section. And we continue to get pretty much on an annual basis kind of soft spots and rutting and things we have to continually maintain. Certainly no lighting, no curbing, no sidewalks, no bicycle facilities, no pedestrian facilities. And it is an area that even for people traveling from Moscow South are using to kind of avoid downtown. They'll come down Mountain View, cross Highway 8, Palouse River Drive to 95, and then on to the south. So even just for our local circulation, that leg from intersection of Highway 8 to 95, I think we're going to see increasing use over time, especially as we have more growth and development in the southeast and southwest portions of the community. So improvements to that would even benefit us significantly. But then continued providing an alternate route for traffic to continue westward would also be a secondary benefit to help alleviate some of the traffic volumes in the downtown core. A few trouble intersections like Washington and 3rd here, where we see that left turn movement having kind of larger delays at times. The total project cost estimate was about $18.9 million. So I think about $5.6 million of that would land on our side of the line, and the rest would be over on Whitman County side.
Under the plan the Moscow City Council approved last night, the city would pay for the design and engineering for the alternate east-west route beginning at the intersection of Mountain View Road and Palouse River Drive and continuing west to U.S. Highway 195 in Washington.
As Congress moves to overturn federal land management plans in three states, a conservation expert says Wyoming is following the standard public process instead. The U.S. House has passed resolutions under the Congressional Review Act to nullify resource management plans in Montana, North Dakota, and Alaska, while Wyoming has faced similar controversies over its plans in Rock Springs and Buffalo, it is not targeted by the current congressional action. David Wilms with the National Wildlife Federation says the administration is working collaboratively to improve those plans.
And they're actually going to work with the public and take public input and work on amending those plans to address some of the underlying concerns that they might have in the resource management plans there, rather than taking this more extreme approach of using the Congressional Review Act.
Wilm says using the Congressional Review Act completely repeals a plan and can prevent agencies from creating similar rules in the future. Proponents argue current land management plans hinder domestic energy production in public lands. Wilms warns that if the Congressional Review Act is successfully used in the three targeted states, it could set a precedent that puts every future land management plan in the West at risk of political repeal.
Every place that's got public lands, the risk is once you do this once, it's going to be done again. The more and more it becomes a political tool to undo actions, other parties can do it too. And it's just going to make land management planning going forward far more complicated.
He adds that this could create long-term uncertainty for industries and users who depend on stable rules for grazing, recreation, and energy development on public lands. This is Tramell Gomes for Wyoming News Service.
The Moscow League of Women Voters has a speaker series event tomorrow. At noon, the Moscow League of Women Voters presents a talk by Speaker Kylie Britzman on seeking the possible over the perfect, compromises, voting rights, and the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution emerged not from idealistic perfection, but from pragmatic compromise among delegates with competing visions for the new nation. This talk examines how the founders navigated fundamental disagreements about representation, federalism, and individual rights to create a workable framework for government. The talk will explore how the Constitution's approach to voting rights, from its original limitations to subsequent expansions through amendments and legislation, reflects this ongoing tension between democratic ideals and political realities. Kylie Britzman is a Lewis Clark State College political science professor. She moved to Moscow in 2018 after completing her PhD at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her research focuses on voting behavior, political rhetoric, and social movement strategies. She is the League of Women Voters of Moscow president. The event is Wednesday at noon at the University of Idaho Library. It is free and open to the public. Due to maintenance at the broadcast tower, KRFP is temporarily off the air at times during daylight hours between today and Tuesday the 23rd. These outages for the FM signal only. KRFP's internet stream at krfp.org and archives at krfp.archive.org will continue to function 24/7. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Take a look at the weather for the Moscow-Pullman area. It'll be mostly clear through Friday. Low 52 tonight, highs 84 tomorrow and Thursday, and 82 on Friday. Lows 52 Wednesday and Thursday night. Current temperature is 75. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ, there's a PayPal option, and there's a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a good night. KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of North Central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.